of the Art of Relating. This is your host, Zach Schwartz, psychologist out in the world and producer and performer of the Art of Relating radio show. Remember, if you have a question or comment about the show, you can contact me at zach@kepw.org or visit my website, dyingskills.com, dyingskills.com, for books, for podcasts of all these radio shows, trainings, other things to help you integrate the concepts and skills that you find useful in the art of relating. So we've been talking about George and Rhonda, my amalgam couple, and how all these concepts and skills applied to that couple in building a healthy relationship. But today I have a special guest, Derek Brando from the University of Oregon, who's an instructor of a class called Confidence in the School of Journalism, where I taught some of this auto relating and stuff at the School of Journalism years ago. So interesting, we should meet, and I learned about him and thought that would relate to the art of relating. Before we turn it over to Derek, however, what did we forget? We forgot grounding. Ground comes first, so let's ground now real brief with me. You should be getting used to me doing that with you and you doing that with you. So five easy pieces. One is the bottom half of your body, feet on the ground, shoulders length apart, toes forward, unlock your knees and hips. You want a good solid contact with the earth. It's your base. You want to have the energy have someplace to go. So relaxed, open joints, knees and hips. Good base. And then you want the top half of your body relaxed and hold a shape. Relaxed to let energy move, let the emotional energy move to the ground. And hold a shape so that you are neither acquiescent nor aggressive, but just centered and positive. Your body talks to your mind. Third is breathe. Two deep grounding breaths in the gut. Fill the chest. Let it all go. One more. Shake out the kinks. Go to the places you know you hold tight and make sure they're not. And finally, self-talk. What do you say in your head to ground yourself? Remember, generically, you can do it any way you want. But generically, we say to relaxers, to affirmers, to unhookers. So relaxers are chill out, fire your retros, take it easy. Affirmers are I have value, I love myself, I'm doing the best I can in this moment. And finally, unhook. Nothing is nothing. It's all small. It's not the end of the world. It's let go. It's be here now. It's when you walk away from an interaction to ground, you want to unhook from that interaction. And that takes practice. All of that together, feeling, I hope, more centered and grounded. So I'm ready. Hopefully you're ready to listen to Derek a little bit. Remember, questions to him can go also through zach@kepw.org. And this is the Art of Relating. And this is Derek, again, who teaches in the School of Journalism at the University of Oregon. So I'm going to turn it over to Derek and let him talk at you for a while.
There we go. Great. Well, thanks for having me, Zach. This is a privilege to be here. So, like you said, I do. I teach at the university in the School of Journalism. I teach a class called Confidence, which is this funny class that you're probably not going to find many places at a university. When I met with Deb Morrison, who is the director of the advertising program, she wanted a class for her advertising students that would give them a competitive advantage when they left the petri dish of the University of Oregon and went into the real world. So prior to me arriving at the university, a good friend of me and my family named Mark Lewis, Emmy award-winning actor, local guy, just brilliant man. Do you know Mark Lewis?
No.
So just Emmy award-winning actor, just brilliant. He just encompassed the room. He actually was teaching this class called Presentation Skills, quote, not just another stage in life, end quote, but he was invited to teach this class that gave these kids this experience outside of their comfort zone. and in a way created a whole different level of confidence and belief in themselves. He unexpectedly passed away, which was heartbreaking for our family and for the university. He really made a deep impact on the students and the faculty and the school journalism. So that was really sad. And then the class was dormant, the way I understand it, for a year or so. And I ended up meeting with a friend of mine for coffee and asked how it was going, finding someone to replace and start teaching that class again. And my friend said they're just having a hard time finding someone to teach this class.
In presentation.
In this class that Mark had built called Presentation Skills, which was this class that create this competitive advantage for kids. So I said, well, Kelly, I don't want to be the guy to follow Mark, but I'll be the guy to follow the guy that follows Mark. So pass all my information to Deb, and if she's interested, like I'd love to chat with her about it. Because I used to teach public speaking in New York when I lived in New York for a while.
Uh-huh. That's why you sound so good now.
That's why. It's amazing. These microphones sound anybody. It make anybody sound kind of good, right? So lo and behold, she gave my name to Deb relatively quickly, and Deb texted me and said we should talk. So we met at this little cafe in town, and we talked about the class, and she said, this is what I want. And she held her hand out like she was holding something with her fingers pointing downward. And she said, this is what I want for my kids. And she didn't use a word. She just kind of opened her hands and let this unseen thing drop.
From an empty hand.
From an empty hand. She's like, this is what I want for my kids. And looking back, maybe it was like an early version of a mic drop. But it was all. I mean, I've been in Eugene enough that it was a little hippie the way she said, and I've been around enough to know like I speak a little hippie, which is so sweet. And I was like, I think I get it. I think I get what you want. I think I can do that. And she offered me the job. She said, all right, I think you're my guy. I want you to come and teach this class, but we're gonna call it Confidence
instead of Presentation.
What's the difference? Well, presentations, presenting. Public speaking is something that you do, but there's way more that comes emotionally as a result of that.
Uh-huh.
So we do public speaking and presenting in a confidence class, but it's not a public speaking and presenting class. It's a confidence class. We just use presenting and public speaking as a medium to grow confidence. So in addition to public speaking and presenting, we do improv. They're a blast, but they're terrifying, right?
They can be,
right?
I was an actor for a while, so I know what that feels like.
Like we're a lot of us are really tied up in this performance to be accepted and to be valued and to be worthy. And we're so afraid of not performing well and what that could mean.
It's natural when I'm performing to focus in. I'm aware of an audience.
Sure.
And that puts pressure on me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I am less anxious if I'm speaking publicly if I'm focused out.
Yeah.
So I'm better off projecting to you, then my anxiety level drops.
And right? I think what I've, and I'm not an improv person, but what I've learned through some of the improv stuff we've done in class is that when you do look inward and make the performance about you instead of making it about what you're giving back to your partner and just being free to go with whatever happens, it can create some problems.
Well, anxiety.
And some pressure and anxiety and fear and all the things. So we do some improv to address and look at some of those things.
Help
and
train them to not, to focus out, to not have that anxiety.
Sure. And then all the other things that come with improv, like the yes and practice, and there's really no wrong answer.
The yes and practice?
The yes, a lot of times when we perform or we're doing something, my understanding of it is, and I'm a relative novice at this, is when you give me something, if I receive it and say yes, acknowledge it, affirm it for what it is, and then add to it. I add to it and give it back to you, then you have something that's new and you can receive and then add more
then
to
add
it.
It grows
and evolves and becomes something. Mm-hmm. If you give something to me in improv, my understanding is that if you say something other than yes and, it kills the show.
I don't know where to go next.
Yeah, it kills the exchange and the life of what it is that you're creating
that
and giving
sense.
Back and forth. But that's a scary thing to perform. Like, oh shoot, you're giving me something. I hope I don't kill this. I hope I don't mess this up. And it's a hard thing to do because we're really tied up in this idea of performing to be accepted and to be loved and to be worthy. And there's none of that in improv because you're just worthy. You just have to play the game.
Yeah.
So another...
That's incidentally the scaredest I've ever been was opening with a 5-minute monologue in a major production in Philadelphia. And it was the first time I'd ever been on a stage. I thought I was going to eat my heart. It was
a
frightening thing.
Right.
Except as soon as it started and I focused out on the audience, I realized that I was the only one that knew the script, not them.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter if I forgot a line. They wouldn't know that as long as I stayed in character.
Right.
And I had their full attention. And from that moment, it was really fun.
And did anybody walk out?
No.
Nobody left.
Having a great time.
Yeah, nobody left. They didn't know. And they were like enjoying themselves.
I know. But that was scary.
The stories that we tell ourselves. It's amazing the stories we tell ourselves when we get into a position that really impact how we view ourselves and how we view our value, how we relate to ourselves. So we do some improv, and then our final for our confidence class is a poetry slam, which really gets in... Poetry slam, which is spoken word. It's not a poetry reading. It's a performance. It's a person writing an original poem, creating something from their own story, having the courage not only to just write it down, and not just to read it, but to actually perform it in a way that gives it life. So
you mean like share it with the class?
Share it with the class, and not just the class, but with about 70 people that come to the final. We open the final up to alumni of Confidence, to faculty, to friends and family. So the class is 20 people. And I teach two of them a term.
Oh, and then you have a bigger audience for this exercise.
So we have a bigger audience for this exercise. I mean, one of the overarching themes of the class is to create emotional discomfort so that they can experience it in a safe and nurturing place. So when they leave the University of Oregon and they get into the professional world and they experience some of this emotional discomfort in their working relationships and how they're working in advertising or whatever profession they pursue, they can look back and say, I know what this feels like. I've been here. I've done that. I don't die.
And they have coping skills, partly what they got from you,
correct,
to deal with it.
And they have some skills to recognize it and then tell themselves something more true than what oftentimes our emotions want to tell us, mm-hmm, which oftentimes isn't mm-hmm true.
See, I have so much practice with people who have social anxiety on learning to focus out. Train yourself to be good at focusing out. Mm-hmm. Like if I go to a party or something, I don't want to focus in while I'm at the party.
Sure.
I'll trip over the coffee table. I'll spill my drink. I won't know what the music is.
Right. It's awkward, painful.
Awkward and painful.
Like you can't see the forest of the trees.
If I'm in the car by myself, and I can focus in, look in the mirror, brush my hair, or whatever.
Right.
But as soon as I put that brush down, we're done with focusing. I walk into the party, I'm focused out, my anxiety level's down, I can then listen to the music, I can respond to a question intelligently, I missed the coffee table.
Right, thank goodness.
Thank goodness. But you're adding an element for me to that, which is also be able to what? So focusing out is one aspect of it.
Right.
But another is adjusting my self-talk.
Absolutely.
Going back to a set of thoughts that I've put in the realm of this will turn my confidence
some
on.
Specific strategies. I have three of them.
Please.
I have three of them that I'll talk about in a second. But I have to tell you though, because it is so deeply rewarding to experience the poetry that these students create, the courage to be seen and be known and to tell their story. It is a true privilege.
In that last project?
In the poetry slam, it's our final. So the classes come together. So instead of 20 and 20, and they meet on different nights, they come together. And there's 40 kids, and they're always scared because they think, oh, it's 20 strangers. But they forget that these 20 people have just been through the same 10 weeks of experience that they have. And then there's faculty there, like other teachers they respect and value their opinions. And then people bring friends and family that show up to hear these poems. People perform this. So, and there's a spotlight and we record them. So it is the final. It is the culminating activity that it captures everything we've done for the term, and it's beautiful. And I'm in tears all night long listening to these kids talk about some of the most raw and scary and wonderful things of their life, like a deeply emotional things.
That's the
things
content of what of they're sharing.
Yep. Right. I mean, these are embedded in the stories they tell, and it's deeply vulnerable. And in our class, when we talk about relating, one of the things that we talk about is vulnerability is the pathway to the connections that we desire the most.
It's funny, when I teach anger management, that's one of my specialties.
Okay.
I teach people that anger is fueled by vulnerability. And when you exchange anger, you're likely to attack or defend. But when you exchange vulnerability, mm-hmm. you're likely to nurture. It seems like saying, so I asked when I'm dealing, intervening with someone who's angry, I'm automatically seeing and feeling their vulnerability. And on that level, we can connect in a positive way.
If you're able to see through or past or around the anger, which I think is a defensive mechanism.
Yes, it's protective.
To not be seen, mm-hmm. because I'm afraid that what's underneath that,
it's vulnerable.
You won't accept.
I'm in danger.
You won't like me. You won't. Yeah. You'll leave me. You'll manipulate or hurt take advantage me. Of me. Exactly. Yeah. I don't want to feel hurt. So anger is my protective mechanism.
Exactly.
In the environment that we create, though, for people to find the courage and practice vulnerability, like you talked about what happened for you when you were on the stage and did your monologue,
yes,
it's terrifying, but you start to give it away and no one leaves. And so for these students in our final, in front of a bunch of strangers, relative strangers, to have the courage to tell this vulnerable, beautiful, courageous story of some experience in their timeline and to allow themselves to be seen and to be known, and to recognize that nobody in the classroom leaves, no one judges, and in fact, everybody is for you and with you, is incredibly satisfying. And I think one of those beautiful moments where we get to realize what this life experience is all about. To have the courage to be seen and have the courage to be known with the uncertainty of, are you going to stick around? But then the reward in the environment that we create, and we create it together, the class and I, that no one's leaving. And in fact, they're for me. They're with me. And they're able to receive me even more so because they see me more than I've ever allowed anyone to see me or in this particular experience before. It's beautiful. It is. And I'm in tears. And then I invited the director of the advertising program came to the final this last term. And she stuck around for the first two or three students. And she and I are both in tears in the back because they're talking about this deepest, most beautiful stuff. And afterwards, I sent her a text message and thanked her for coming. And she sent me a text message back and said, are you just emotionally gutted after these things? I was like, yeah. I am. I'm exhausted. It takes me weeks to recover.
Yeah.
But it is so valuable because of the connection that everyone in the room experiences. Even if you're a guest that night, To be able to sit in and witness and participate in that kind of vulnerability, you feel connection to people that you don't even know. And that's what vulnerability does. It allows the kind of connection that we are the most hungry for. So that is that's the confidence class. It's wonderful.
So the three things you said, there were three things.
So let's talk about, and this goes into the relating piece that I think would be really relevant for what you're doing on the show, Zach, is great, how I set them up to dig in to their stories to know what to write about. Because I think we take 3 weeks to get into this poem.
To write the
final poem.
Sharing.
Right. And it starts off with, I'm making this up, but it starts off with real surface level things because people just don't know how.
Yeah,
to
I was
be
born
seen
in New York,
and
I
be
had one sister.
Right, like let me write a poem about my dog Fido, and right. it's got this Dr. Seuss kind of cadence: one fish, two fish, red fish, blue yeah. fish, because that's what poetry is, right?
Sure.
So we dig into that, we explore it, we show all kinds of examples, which are really rewarding. And what happens is I give them this cadence by which to operate that I have learned from Dr. Brené Brown. And she is a researcher, storyteller. She's got one of the most popular TED Talks on TED. And her TED Talk is called The Power of Vulnerability. I would encourage anyone to listen to it. She's written several books. She teaches at the University of Houston. And she does a lot of work in shame, vulnerability, wholehearted living. And all those things resonate deeply with my personal experience, which is a whole different story. But we dig into some strategies that she's unpacked and she's pulled out of her research. And so what she's identified in her research of interviewing thousands and thousands of people about their experience is that the people that have strategies to be resilient to shame, and shame is one of those things that can just crush us, cripple us, kill our relationships, kill the relationship we have with ourselves, and deeply impact the relationships we have with each other, is people who have the most wholehearted experience in life, the most like satisfying life experience relating with themselves and each other, is they have these things called rising skills. So I'm sharing with you the
rising skills.
So this is the work of Brené Brown, and I'm totally bought into it. My buddy Tom Lundberg, he jokingly calls me a brownie boy because I'm like so like bought into this right now. But her work really is it's resonating deeply with me over the last several years. So she says people that have the best experience in life, they live the most wholehearted life, are the ones that have rising skills. So when they experience something, they have these three strategies on how to cope with shame. So first of all,
when I think about shame, just my own formulation of the work I do, I think about guilt and shame, and guilt is accusing myself of having done something wrong. But shame is more of a character assassination.
Yep.
Not I did bad, but I am bad.
Exactly.
And so to me, shame is a kind of mental illness, whereas guilt can be useful.
And we are all...
depends how you process
it. And we all suffer. If shame is a mental illness, we all suffer from it.
Sure.
At one point or another.
Absolutely.
The difference is some of us respond to it in different ways.
Yeah.
And the people, and I've experienced this in my own life. I've recognized this cadence by which she prescribes rising strongly from
my cadence. Do you mean a rhythm in how I speak to myself?
A general rhythm, like action steps, or a way that I process the experience. Mm-hmm. So she says there are three things: there's a reckoning, a rumble, and a revolution. And so. Okay. Number one, she says, reckon is recognizing that I am hooked. And a lot of times...
hooked meaning...
like, recognize that I'm emotionally hooked, because what happens
I'm tied to a situation or a...
My emotions have taken over the car. My emotions are driving.
I'm driving the car, right.
They have kicked intellect into the trunk. Intellect has no voice in
acting
the behavior.
Yeah.
My emotions are driving, and we know what happens. We can all examine our own experience. We know what happens when our emotions take over. For me, my emotions drive me downtown to crazy town. I'm unreasonable, and I behave in ways that don't align with my values, and it's not who I want to be. So, and she says that most of us don't grow up in an environment where we are encouraged to be curious about our emotions, nor do we have a robust emotional vocabulary to be able to identify what we're feeling and give it a name.
True.
And a lot of times what happens is when we don't even, we know we're feeling something, but we don't know what it is. We can't give it a name. And it has control. So recognizing that I'm emotionally hooked, having the emotional vocabulary to identify what it is that I'm feeling, whether it's good or bad, whether it's joy or anger. And that's funny. There's a guy that has this he's created the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, which gives words.
This is great stuff. The
yeah.
Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows.
Yep. He creates words that pair with specific emotional experiences, and he's got these great like 1 or 2 minute videos. They're really fun to watch. So recognizing that something's going, I'm emotionally hooked. What is it? Give it a name. Number one. Number two.
When you say emotionally hooked, you mean my emotions have the steering wheel.
Correct. And there's usually a physiological manifestation when we're emotionally hooked. For me, my stomach drops out. My heart gets hollow. I can feel the blood rushing to my cheeks. There's a physiological response. So if we want to know.
So that's a signal that you can build something new from.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
There's a physiological response. I recognize it. I'm hooked. What is it? Get curious. Give yourself permission to be curious about what you're feeling. Number two, she says, and I love it, is the rumble. We wrestle with what it is. And one of the beautiful things that she says is if we can ask this or say this one statement, then we can get to the next hurdle, which is, and she says, the story I'm telling myself is. And we get, this goes back to relating with ourselves. Right. We tell ourselves stories all the time, and our brains are hardwired for story. We want to make meaning of our experience. And when we have input here, and input here, but we don't have input over here and here, our brains can't deal with the ambiguity of it. So we fill in the blanks. Right. We create a story.
Right.
Zach looked at me this way. Oh, he's pissed at me.
They say that's what dreams are. A bunch of still shots where your brain fills in the gaps and turns it into a story. So it plays like a movie.
Yep. And that's the story we tell ourselves, which if we're emotionally hooked, might not be the real story. So to be able to say, this is the story I'm telling myself, and to write it down or to speak it out, a lot of times that's when we invite our intellect back into the conversation, and our intellect can say like, well, hi, Crazy Town. Let's step back here and take a look at this. So, the story I'm telling myself is the powerful second step, and then the third step is the revolution. When we're able to recognize that we are emotionally hooked, and give that a name, and then we give ourselves the permission to say the story I'm telling myself is, and we see that, we give ourselves the authority and the power to rewrite the ending of that story. Talk about relating with yourself. I think these are some of the most powerful strategies I've learned to be able to relate with yourself healthily, to rise from some of the shame that we can experience from what we receive from outside sources that really impact the story we tell with ourselves. Recognize that we're emotionally hooked. The story that I'm telling myself is, and then we can rewrite the ending of that.
It's funny. One of the things I think of is having an ego and a soul. My ego being Zach, my soul being what I call Obi-Wan Zach. And when I work with clients, I'll say, let Obi drive, you know, which is not, don't put your emotions behind the wheel.
Right.
So when you feel that, move that part of you to the other seat, put their seatbelt on, find Obi-Wan, put him behind the wheel, and then what would you do? It's just sort of a therapeutic mechanism to play with.
I think that's good, and I think the danger oftentimes is we take emotion and we kick it out of the car instead of it allowing emotion into the conversation, but just not letting it drive. Emotion is so powerful and beautiful. It's a part of our experience, and we have to have it.
Yes.
It's one of those. It's the most beautiful. One of the most beautiful things about who we are. Yeah. So to allow emotion to stay in the conversation but not let it drive is beautiful.
Yeah, that's an important thing. And important in the art of relating. It's easier for me to be considerate, listen to my partner, do all of these things if I can focus out, if I can stay grounded. And the teaches what you teach is beautiful stuff.
And this is very much a grounding process. Yes, anyway, this has been great. Thanks, Zach.
Well, you're very welcome. We've been listening to Derek Brando, instructor at the University of Oregon, in a class called Confidence, and I think it was just great stuff. Hope you did, too. Remember, you can write in a comment or a question for me or Derek at zach@kepw.org, or visit the website, dyinskills.com, dyinskills, if you want to communicate, if you want to look at other material. And if you're fascinated, I was, by what Derek shared, you could certainly seek him out at the university.
Absolutely. I have an email. Is that something that you allow people to share? Yeah, I'm dbrando, B-R-A-N-D-O-W, @uoregon.edu.
That's dbrando. Well, thanks again for listening to The Art of Relating, and have a good week. Remember to practice, internalize, and integrate. And we will speak more at episode 29, because we skipped one, next week.